Welcome to the Inclusive Education Project. I'm Vicki Brett.
I'm Amanda Salohi. We're two civil rights lawyers on a mission to change the conversation about education, civil rights, and modern activism.
Each week, we're going to explore new topics which are going to educate and empower others
and give them a platform to enact change in education and level the playing field.
Welcome, listeners.
Hi, friends.
We are in it. For some people, it's like the last 6 weeks of the school year.
Yeah.
We are in IEP meetings. I feel like I'm in an IEP meeting almost every other day.
Yeah. Well, it's wild because like we used to feel this way at the end of the school year where it was like back to back to back. The last few years, I feel like it's been a little bit lighter at the end of the school year. And this year it's like, okay, no, we're back to normal of IEPs all the time, which I mean, in many ways is a good thing. Like we want to have the teams have IEP meetings. We want to try to get information back and forth between the families and the school district. It's really important to not just have IEPs annually. So, you know, we encourage it.
Right. I mean, I just got an assessment plan and I'm like, how are you going to complete this? I mean, it's our assistive technology. So it's not like a lengthy one, but it's like, we're going to get this done. Like, so you're going to speed through it. Like, what's going to happen? So it'll be really interesting. And on that note, this is actually a part two. Our part one was a solo episode about English language learners. And we are so excited to have Dr. Tan, who is a board certified clinical neuropsychologist and supervisor at Children's Hospital of Orange County, CHOC. And he's also in private practice. Dr. Tan, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, yes. Good to be here with you guys. I'm happy to be here.
So we sought you out specifically because you provide bilingual services with your neuropsychologist evaluations. And I just kind of wanted you to introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners and how you came to CHOC.
Sure. Yes. Well, you know, I have always been interested in the relationship between the brain and how that affects behavior. And so that's actually what the lens through which neuropsychologists practice. And a distinction that I kind of actually wanted to make right from the beginning related to my perspective as a neuropsychologist, you know, we really evaluate the impact of a disability on cognition, on learning, and on behavior for the purpose of determining the optimal treatment plan. That's a little bit different from an IEP evaluation, right, which determines the function is kind of to determine whether a disability has an adverse impact on learning and whether there's a need for special education services. And I think that distinction is important because many times our neuropsychological evaluations become really helpful in advocating for IEPs, right? Because an IEP
absolutely
evaluation will kind of look at, does the disability currently affect, right, kind of learning and education?
Yeah.
We kind of have the lens of, you know, how will this medical history or how will this disability affect the trajectory of development, cognition? And so, you know, that I think aligns well with the goals, even your program, you know, to help advocate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so much of education is developing the brain and developing skills. And if we try to take the perspective of this developmental is a medical side and educational is different, it's academic, we are separating things that really need to be talked about hand in hand.
Right. Definitely. And that kind of is really what led me to wanting to become a neuropsychologist. You know, I was interested in the holistic functioning of children, you know, not just their medical history, but also their cognitive development, their learning and their school environment, their behavior, their psychosocial functioning. I was interested in all of those things, you know, and neuropsychology is the discipline that allows us to look at all of those aspects of a child holistically. And so it's very rewarding work. I have been at Children's Medical Center Dallas in Texas. I've been at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta on the East Coast. And now I'm here at Children's Hospital of Orange County on the West Coast. So I'm clearly very working with children. All the hospitals I've worked at have the name children in it. But
yeah.
that,
you've probably seen a range, of course, of the different states too. And I think the separation, if you will, of like medical history and diagnoses and like what the IEP team can provide, you know, we still get this, oh, your child qualifies under autism. We cannot give you a diagnosis, right, as a school district, because we, you know, we're not medical professionals. And but then the other way around, right? Like when a parent does bring a diagnosis, it's like, well, we can, you know, it has to impact the academics and the access. And we find so much value in the work that you do, because there's, you can't just like scream into the void. Like there are other things that affect the child. And we feel with the most recent Supreme Court case of Andrew F, where it's taking into the, you know, the circumstances of the child, you know, that could include homelessness, and that can include the effect of the brain on the child. So we were really excited to be able to talk to you in light of that, because we have had neuropsychologists on our podcast talking about what their evaluations are, how they're presented, and how they've been in IEP meetings. And that was either right before Andrew F or right in the wake of that. And of course, we've had some years to see how it, you know, how we can use these evaluations in addition to all the other information that the school district themselves, you know, have uncovered. But I did want to kind of bring to light that you also speak another language. What language is that?
Yeah, so I actually provide services both in Spanish and in Mandarin Chinese. So we provide evaluations in three languages. I would say the Spanish is what comes way more often to me, especially at Children's Hospital of Orange County. You know, we're a nonprofit hospital servicing, you know, Santa Ana, Orange, Anaheim, you know, very high percentage of Hispanic families. And also, you know, working frequently with, we're actually the only neuropsychology team servicing Medi-Cal in Orange County as well. So,
Oh, wow. I didn't
wow,
realize that.
that's so important. And, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on, and this, as we talked about at the beginning of this episode, this is a part two, because we had an episode where we talked about designation as an English language learner and services regarding students' IEP and how that relates. And one thing that isn't talked about enough is the assessment in this child's native language. It very rarely gets done, but often we find it is very important to have either components or full IEPs in a student's native language. And so we wanted to kind of get, and we love that you provide services in other languages, because not all parents, not all students are proficient in English, and it's important that we get an accurate, you know, idea of their ability. So can you talk through what it looks like if you get someone who is maybe a family's bilingual, or the student is learning English in school, and how you'd go about the process of determining, do you do parts or whole assessments in a language other than English?
Yeah, these are all great questions, and there's so much I could say. And so just thinking about even how to frame this conversation. And so maybe I'll just start high level, and then we can certainly go into different details. But from my perspective, right, first of all, just for us to conduct an individualized and responsible assessment with a diverse child, I think there's really two factors that I'm considering. And perhaps this could frame the conversation today. One is, we need to sufficiently account for the interaction effects between neurodiversity and English language learning. And I would also, side note, argue that there's language is just one aspect of culture. And so really considering the interaction between neurodiversity and the accompanying cultural context, including, you know, language. And then the second factor is, we also need to do our due diligence to minimize the limitations that are presented by our assessment tools that we use, of which there are many. And, you know, I can't tell you how many parents come to me with IEP assessments where either the child is incorrectly demonstrated to have cognitive impairments or learning disabilities, or conversely, to not need educational services because of both of them being because of insufficient consideration of language and culture, or of inappropriate assessment methods. And, you know, I, you know, fully recognize that as a field, we are growing in this, I guess, in this way. And it's not necessarily realistic that we always find someone that literally speaks the language of the family, particularly if they're, you know, less commonly spoken languages. And even when we do have someone that speaks a language, you know, all some of our tools are wildly become invalid as well. So
Yes.
it's more so about really, I think, the consciousness and the due diligence to make the assessment as individualized and responsible as possible, as opposed to kind of these, you know, requirements of language or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's perhaps how I thought to introduce this, you know, conversation.
Yeah.
There's many details I could, you know, say.
That's very helpful. And I think that consideration piece is so important because that is what we often find. Like, you would think the amount of students that we get that English was not their first language, they go in through the IEP process and we get them middle to late elementary school and they've never had a bilingual assessment, not even their first. You know, and we look back and we talk to the families and we say, you know, was this something that was discussed? Did you guys talk about it? And it seems like it just was never even something that crossed the school psychologist's mind to even consider this. It's like we're checking a box saying that English isn't their native language and that, or their first language, and that we are doing the standardized testing, the ELLD or ELL standardized testing that we have. But then we leave it at that and we don't even, like, there's no analysis of why should we do more or shouldn't do more in this case, the individualization. Like, I just, we don't see it happening.
Yeah. And I think the maybe one fundamental barrier is if we are going to do an evaluation, let's just say on a bilingual child, to really provide kind of a fair evaluation really requires some knowledge of how bilingualism interacts with the developing brain, right? We can't be checking boxes, you know, based on language. Bilingualism is a very multifaceted construct, right? There's a lot of different ways bilingualism can look. I mean, even just off the top of my head, you know, when I get a child that, you know, in their chart, it says they're bilingual, there's a lot of questions I need to ask, right? So for example, was this a simultaneous language acquisition or was it a sequential language acquisition, right? So if it was simultaneous, if both languages were being developed right from early childhood, then, you know, our research does show that these children typically do not differ from monolingual children in terms of initial developmental milestones or total size of vocabulary across languages. But then we need to use the correct tools, right, to make sure that we're measuring that accurately. Whereas if we have a situation with sequential language acquisition, you know, we have one language that was primarily spoken in the home, and then it's followed by a second language at a later age, a lot of times when child enters school, right, they're starting to learn English maybe. Then go into, well, what kind of language environment are they in? Is it an additive language environment where both languages are being fostered across everyday settings? Is it a subtractive language development where, you know, child is losing skills in the first language because of the exposure to the second language, just due to a loss of support for that first language outside the home? Is this an early bilingualism case or a late bilingualism case? You know, there's a huge cutoff in neuroplasticity at around age 12. And so, you know, when the sequential language is being acquired, you know, it kind of determines also how much the second language is mediated by the first language, right? And then there's, you know, language we use for basic interpersonal communication, our language of social interaction. There's our cognitive academic language proficiency, so the language we use for educational achievement. And those processes look different too in terms of development in the brain. So I say all this, you know, rapid fire just to say, you know, if the evaluation does not consider all these aspects of bilingualism, then are we fairly, are we accurately representing the child, right? And IEP, you know, maybe that's not their primary question. Maybe the question is just, well, you know, yes, all of that, but like, do they need these services, right? Whereas for me, the perspective I'm really looking at is if I need to fairly represent this child to determine, right, kind of what their trajectory is going to look like and what the optimal services, what services would be optimal for their development.
And I mean, the way that you just even broke it down, I know you said it was rapid fire, but I don't think I've ever been in an IEP meeting where those considerations were even like touched upon, you know? And
no,
and
not even after we've asked.
Right. Well, that, I mean, Amanda has a case right now where it's, yeah, it's pretty apparent. Like, they do not have the funding, resources, or expertise to even engage in a conversation. And it's unfortunate because you know, I know that there's a lot of pressure for teachers to be a little bit of everything, but at the end of the day, we would hope that they would become the expert in the child, similar to a parent, so that they can say, I think we need to dig a little bit deeper, because as you had mentioned, you know, it's just, it's really almost like a box that they need to check off, you know, whether the child needs services or not. We've said this several times on the podcast, most districts appear to be reactive rather than proactive. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, that's just the way we do things, you know, and they're really not taking into consideration, you know, so many other things, unless they're trying to like blame a parent, right? Like, oh, well, he's overly emotional because you're going through a divorce, which we've heard that said. It's really fascinating for us as we've dived in with several people about the brain and what we now know. And, you know, it's not fringe science anymore. You know, the brain is plastic, you know, neural pathways can be created, and to be able to have a picture of where that child is, which you provide, you know, a clear picture, I would imagine would be such a vital piece of information. What has been your experience when you have provided the results to a parent? Do you kind of get a mix of relief, frustration, disbelief, denial? What has been your experience?
I get the whole spectrum, you know.
Yeah.
It just depends on the situation. But a lot of times, I think the frustration from the parent is, you know, like, I knew this, right? Like, I knew my kid wasn't cognitively impaired. It's just, you know, hasn't learned English, you know? And,
right.
And sometimes it's like, but, you know, I guess the results are demonstrating, right, that they're kind of have these cognitive impairments. Or the opposite, right? It's kind of like, you know, like, I knew there was something, you know, wrong. I knew there was, a delay, but everyone was just telling me, oh, it's just because he's bilingual. Oh, it's because, you know, so I see those things, and both of those, you know, directions are, you know, quite frustrating to parents who know that the evaluation that they get is not painting a fair representation of their child.
Right. Right. And I think the same sometimes goes for behavior, right? Because communication is a behavior, and we often see kids who have behaviors and it's just thought, oh, it's just a maladaptive behavior, or it's, you know, a behavior because of this or that, or attention. And we're forgetting the piece of they're trying to communicate, or they don't understand what you're asking of them.
No, that's very well put. Actually, you know, and that's part of what a neuropsychologist has to consider, and why we always evaluate so comprehensively across cognitive domains, because the interaction effects between language and, for example, attention or behavior, even for development, social, you know, development of social functioning, you know, that all comes into play, right, with their own kind of interactions. And so, you know, I've had situations where a school comes back and says, hey, like, you should really evaluate them for ADHD. When really it's like, hey, how are you supposed to pay attention in the classroom when you have no idea what's going on, right? And you're in the wrong setting. Mm-hmm. So I think the benefits of a neuropsychological evaluation, or just a fair evaluation that's culturally and linguistically responsive, you know, really helps us to avoid some of these major, major risks, right? I can think of a situation I had recently where, you know, the child was a simultaneous language acquisition situation. And so everyone was just saying, oh, you know, even pediatricians are saying, oh, don't worry, you know, it's just because they have two languages in the household, they'll catch up.
Yes.
But when I had my evaluation, there was a true language disorder that was missed. And imagine if we had, you know, if someone had flagged it earlier, we had caught it earlier, they could have benefited from, you know, speech language therapy, you know, from a much earlier age, when that would have a better impact on the brain.
Yeah.
And so now we're in a situation where, you know, things just kept getting chalked to the bilingualism, and then now their language, you know, their actual language abilities have suffered. And that's, you know, a risk on one side. There's risks on the other side where, you know, we've had situations where this had happened to me recently, where it was a simultaneous language acquisition and it was kind of a subtractive learning environment. So not only was the primary language of Spanish starting to fall behind, but also the English, you know, the secondary language was not necessarily developing rapidly enough as well. And this was a kid that ended up getting, you know, kind of evaluated to be cognitively impaired, right? And so really my evaluation was helpful in the sense of I think parsing all these different factors out, right? And sometimes I even do the same measures in both languages just because there are some aspects of mastery in one language, you know, for some things, and then some aspects of mastery for another. So all of these things are, you know, I think are important to fully consider to accurately represent the patient. And that second case, you know, it became about, hey, like, this isn't a cognitive impairment. This is like, this person needs, you know, ELL services, right? And which they weren't getting, you know. So imagine if that had happened earlier, you know, if that had been flagged earlier, we wouldn't be in the situation where now they're failing school, right? They're not meeting milestones, et cetera. So anyway, forgive me
Exactly
for
right.
if my tone becomes
No, this
frustrating,
is
but
exactly our jam. No, this is
you are preaching to
exactly.
the, yeah. I mean, and it's something that is just not talked about enough that I think that there's a lot of parents that are likely listening to this that are probably like, that was never even a thought. Because I mean, I recently had a client where the child was in fourth grade, and I asked, it was a brand new client, and I asked, you know, looking through your file and looking through, you know, initial assessments and seeing that English wasn't this child's first language, and there's no designation of ELL. Did they ever do testing? And she was like, what even is that? You know, and that's a family who advocated and knew enough to come and get an attorney and had, you know, advocated for a number of things for years, but didn't even know that that was something that should be considered. And so I think it was so important for us to highlight it and stress the importance of it too, that it's not just some minor notation on the IEP, that it is a very important consideration for a lot of these kiddos. And so we so appreciate you coming and explaining and talking through this with us.
Oh, I was just going to say, if parents wanted to reach out to you, how what would be the best way?
My private practice website is www.alexandertanphd.com, and so there is a way to contact me through that avenue. And so that's my practice that I use to serve the community outside of CHOC as well. I was going to just based on what Amanda was mentioning, you know, wanted to, as I'm on the soapbox, just wanted to shoehorn in another consideration, which is, you know, language is not the only aspect of culture, right? It's sometimes the most obvious one, but, you know, the fear is where sometimes the language is sufficient, but then because it's sufficient, then now suddenly none of culture is considered in the interpretation of the results. And I'll give you the most glaring example. You know, I can't tell you the surprising number of times that an Asian child has come to me with a diagnosis of autism when there wasn't a full account of the differences, not only in language mechanics between English and Mandarin Chinese, which we touched on the first episode, but also beyond that, communication style, right? Use of nonverbal communication and eye contact and what that represents from a cultural standpoint. Completely different. And so it's you know, I've had kids, you know, Asian kids come to me with these diagnoses of autism, and it's like if we had just given a culturally responsible evaluation, right, that considers all the aspects of culture, not just language, but what about cultural values? What about economic issues affecting the family? Communication styles, even like what the concept of intelligence even means, you know, or what the comfort with a testing environment, you know, no, I find that those factors are completely thrown out the window in many interpretations, when in fact they have such a interaction effect as well with development and their performance on our evaluations.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, with Andrew F. that I had talked about at the top of the episode, you know, how are we creating an IEP that is reasonably calculated, right, to enable that child to make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances? And that phrase there, like the children's circumstances, has really enabled us to really, like you were just saying, take all those things into consideration. On top of that, the pandemic, in which there's a collective trauma that we all experience, that I know Amanda and I constantly have to bring up in IEP meetings, because even though we're 4 years out, it doesn't mean that the child wasn't affected in some capacity. And that could be a discussion for another day. We've already taken so much of your time. we want to thank you so much for coming on. And yeah, if you guys will have his information also in the show notes, and we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.